This is the listening part of your Year 12 exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice. Task 1. You have a minute to read the task.
When visitors enter Planet Word, a new museum in Washington, D.C., they will see Speaking Willow, a tall art piece representing a tree. As they pass under the artwork, they can hear recordings of speech in hundreds of languages coming from the tree. Most words sound foreign to the listeners. The different voices also speak at the same time. The resulting noise is similar to that made in a crowded theatre before a show begins. Rafael Lonzano Hemmer completed the piece last year. On his website, the artist says that Speaking Willow reminds us that language is what defines our specific communities and connects our many cultures. It is the first of many immersive experiences for visitors at Planet Word, a museum all about words and language. The exhibits playfully explore the large and complex subject of language. Anne Friedman is Planet Word's founder and director. In one room, a video plays, showing babies saying their first words. Another room, called Where Do Words Come From, teaches the history of some common English words. The space includes a 22-foot-tall wall of words, where visitors speak into devices and learn about the roots of the English language. That exhibit took 2 years to build, Friedman said. Another room invites listeners to speak and learn about different languages. Native speakers of 28 languages and 2 sign languages teach people sayings in those languages. They also explain how language shapes their understanding of the world and how words cannot be separated from culture. For example, a Japanese language presenter discussed how politeness is very important to Japanese culture. The language has several words to choose from in addressing another person. The words speak to the nature of the relationship between the speaker and listener. Other rooms explore the different ways language is used, from humor and songwriting to public speaking and advertising. Visitors can sing karaoke while learning about songwriting, record a famous speech, play a joke-telling game, and teach a computer how to make cartoons. One exhibition room is all about books. It is designed to look like an old, rich library. Books line the shelves. When a book is placed on the table, a recorded reading begins and pictures appear. Planet Word is housed in Washington's historic Franklin School. The DC government gave limited control of the property to Friedman in 2017. She has spent $35 million on the building and the museum. Friedman is a former teacher. She wanted to create a museum to build interest and curiosity in writing and language. The museum is designed mainly for teenagers, but most adults can also learn from and enjoy a visit to Planet Word. Friedman hopes people will leave the museum with a better understanding of the words they use every day and the world of languages around them.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
When visitors enter Planet Word, a new museum in Washington, D.C., they will see Speaking Willow, a tall art piece representing a tree. As they pass under the artwork, they can hear recordings of speech in hundreds of languages coming from the tree. Most words sound foreign to the listeners. The different voices also speak at the same time. The resulting noise is similar to that made in a crowded theatre before a show begins. Rafael Lonzano Hemmer completed the piece last year. On his website, the artist says that Speaking Willow reminds us that language is what defines our specific communities and connects our many cultures. It is the first of many immersive experiences for visitors at Planet Word, a museum all about words and language. The exhibits playfully explore the large and complex subject of language. Anne Friedman is Planet Word's founder and director. In one room, a video plays, showing babies saying their first words. Another room, called Where Do Words Come From, teaches the history of some common English words. The space includes a 22-foot-tall wall of words, where visitors speak into devices and learn about the roots of the English language. That exhibit took 2 years to build, Friedman said. Another room invites listeners to speak and learn about different languages. Native speakers of 28 languages and 2 sign languages teach people sayings in those languages. They also explain how language shapes their understanding of the world and how words cannot be separated from culture. For example, a Japanese language presenter discussed how politeness is very important to Japanese culture. The language has several words to choose from in addressing another person. The words speak to the nature of the relationship between the speaker and listener. Other rooms explore the different ways language is used, from humor and songwriting to public speaking and advertising. Visitors can sing karaoke while learning about songwriting, record a famous speech, play a joke-telling game, and teach a computer how to make cartoons. One exhibition room is all about books. It is designed to look like an old, rich library. Books line the shelves. When a book is placed on the table, a recorded reading begins and pictures appear. Planet Word is housed in Washington's historic Franklin School. The DC government gave limited control of the property to Friedman in 2017. She has spent $35 million on the building and the museum. Friedman is a former teacher. She wanted to create a museum to build interest and curiosity in writing and language. The museum is designed mainly for teenagers, but most adults can also learn from and enjoy a visit to Planet Word. Friedman hopes people will leave the museum with a better understanding of the words they use every day and the world of languages around them.
There is half a minute now to finish the task.
This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have a minute to read the task.
One morning this summer, I paid a visit to the Seoul United Nations Agency in London. The headquarters of the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, sit on the southern bank of the Thames, a short distance upstream from the Houses of Parliament. Inside, I met a dozen or so mostly female IMO translators. I walked upstairs to a glass-fronted booth where I prepared to witness something both absolutely remarkable and utterly routine. The booth was about the size of a garden shed and well lit but stuffy. Below us were the gently curving desks of the delegate hall, which was about half full, occupied mostly by men in suits. I sat down between two interpreters, Marissa Pinckney and Carmen Cellino. The first delegate started speaking. Pinckney switched on her microphone. She paused briefly and then began translating the delegate's English sentences into Spanish. As the delegate spoke, Pinckney had to make sense of a message composed in one language while simultaneously constructing and articulating the same message in a different language. The process required an extraordinary blend of sensory, motor, and cognitive skills, all of them operating in unison. She did so continuously and in real time, without asking the speaker to slow down or clarify anything. Nothing in our evolutionary history can have programmed Pinckney's brain for a task so peculiar and demanding. Executing it required versatility and nuance beyond the reach of the most powerful computers. It's a wonder that her brain, indeed any human brain, can do it at all. Looking down over the delegates at the IMO in London, I was reminded of the view from a captain's bridge or from the gallery of a television studio. It engendered a feeling of being in control, a perverse reaction given that control is one thing interpreters lack. The words they utter and the speed at which they talk are determined by others. And even though Pinckney and Cellino had advanced copies of some of the speeches being given that morning, they had to be alive to humorous asides. Pun, sarcasm, irony, and culture-specific jokes are an interpreter's nightmare. Many of the delegates spoke in English, so the pressure on Anne Miles in the Into English booth down the hall was sporadic. Miles, who speaks French, German, Italian, and Russian, has been interpreting for 30 years. In between translating, she told me about word order, another challenge that interpreters face daily. Some speakers talk too fast. There are various strategies, Miles told me. Some interpreters think it's best just to stop and say the delegate is talking too fast. Mars herself doesn't find that any of that is useful because people have a natural pace, and someone asked to slow down is likely to pick up speed again. The alternative is to pracy. You have to be quick on the uptake. It's not just language skills in this job. It's being quick-brained and learning fast.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
One morning this summer, I paid a visit to the Seoul United Nations Agency in London. The headquarters of the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, sit on the southern bank of the Thames, a short distance upstream from the Houses of Parliament. Inside, I met a dozen or so mostly female IMO translators. I walked upstairs to a glass-fronted booth where I prepared to witness something both absolutely remarkable and utterly routine. The booth was about the size of a garden shed and well-lit but stuffy. Below us were the gently curving desks of the delegate hall, which was about half full, occupied mostly by men in suits. I sat down between two interpreters, Marissa Pinckney and Carmen Cellino. The first delegate started speaking. Pinckney switched on her microphone. She paused briefly and then began translating the delegate's English sentences into Spanish. As the delegate spoke, Pinckney had to make sense of a message composed in one language while simultaneously constructing and articulating the same message in a different language. The process required an extraordinary blend of sensory, motor, and cognitive skills, all of them operating in unison. She did so continuously and in real time, without asking the speaker to slow down or clarify anything. Nothing in our evolutionary history can have programmed Pinckney's brain for a task so peculiar and demanding. Executing it required versatility and nuance beyond the reach of the most powerful computers. It's a wonder that her brain, indeed any human brain, can do it at all. Looking down over the delegates at the IMO in London, I was reminded of the view from a captain's bridge or from the gallery of a television studio. It engendered a feeling of being in control, a perverse reaction given that control is one thing interpreters lack. The words they utter and the speed at which they talk are determined by others. And even though Pinckney and Cellino had advanced copies of some of the speeches being given that morning, they had to be alive to humorous asides. Pun, sarcasm, irony, and culture-specific jokes are an interpreter's nightmare. Many of the delegates spoke in English, so the pressure on Anne Miles in the Into English booth down the hall was sporadic. Miles, who speaks French, German, Italian, and Russian, has been interpreting for 30 years. In between translating, she told me about word order, another challenge that interpreters face daily. Some speakers talk too fast. There are various strategies, Miles told me. Some interpreters think it's best just to stop and say the delegate is talking too fast. Miles herself doesn't find that any of that is useful because people have a natural pace, and someone asked to slow down is likely to pick up speed again. The alternative is to pracy. You have to be quick on the uptake. It's not just language skills in this job. It's being quick-brained and learning fast.
There is half a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task two. Go on to task three. You have a minute to read the task.
All right, so it's been 15 years since Pluto was kicked out of the Planet Club. It also happens to be the topic of our very first episode of AstronomyCast more than 600 episodes ago. Are there any updates? Does Pluto have a chance of regaining planethood status again? All right, so I guess we should kind of catch, I mean, for people who don't know what happened to poor Pluto, why don't we catch people up briefly on what happened?
So, poor Pluto. It was officially discovered in 1930. It had appeared in a few images prior to that, but hadn't been like identified as Pluto prior to 1930. And when it was first found, it was the culmination of Percival Lowell funding Lowell Observatory and saying there is another world out there and we're going to find it. And when Clyde Tombaugh found it, all of the astronomers were like, that's really not enough light for what we were looking for, and maybe we don't actually need another large world out there. We think we can explain Neptune now. And nevertheless, Percival Lowell and everyone else involved in making his dream come true had decided a priori they were finding a planet. So Pluto became our ninth planet until 2006, when during a meeting of the International Astronomical Union, folks were like, look, Pluto is no longer the biggest thing out in the Kuiper Belt. Right. There's this thing called Eris. And Sirius lost its planethood when we found the rest of the asteroid belt. So let's make Pluto something else. It was more complicated than that. There were more details to that. But that is the TLDR version of what happened. And in 2006, an entire room full of professional astronomers from around the world raised their colored pieces of paper that designate, yes, I am a member of this organization. And holding those high, they, in a kind of close vote, downvoted Pluto's status, and it was determined we're now going to have dwarf planets, and Pluto would be the lead object in a new group called Plutinos. And I don't think anyone's really used that word since.
No, it's definitely fallen out of favor. Were you there for that vote?
No. Okay. No, I actually, so 2006, I was that August moving from Boston to Edwardsville to start my job as a professor. The very next IAU, I would become a member. But that particular IAU, I was coming up with this show, enjoying just married life and realizing, wow, home ownership is a lot.
Right. But normally you do attend the International Astronomical Union meetings, and you've been to others since.
Yes.
Yeah.
And every year the question comes up, is this the year we're going to reopen that can of worms? And every year we're like, nope, this is not.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
All right. So it's been 15 years since Pluto was kicked out of the Planet Club. It also happens to be the topic of our very first episode of AstronomyCast more than 600 episodes ago. Are there any updates? Does Pluto have a chance of regaining planethood status again? All right. So I guess we should kind of catch, I mean, for people who don't know what happened to poor Pluto, why don't we catch people up briefly on what happened?
So poor Pluto. It was officially discovered in 1930. It had appeared in a few images prior to that, but hadn't been like identified as Pluto prior to 1930. And when it was first found, it was the culmination of Percival Lowell funding Lowell Observatory and saying there is another world out there and we're going to find it. And when Clyde Tombaugh found it, all of the astronomers were like, that's really not enough light for what we were looking for. And maybe we don't actually need another large world out there. We think we can explain Neptune now. And nevertheless, Percival Lowell and everyone else involved in making his dream come true had decided a priori they were finding a planet. So Pluto became our ninth planet until 2006, when during a meeting of the International Astronomical Union, folks were like, look, Pluto is no longer the biggest thing out in the Kuiper Belt. Right. There's this thing called Eris. And Sirius lost its planethood when we found the rest of the asteroid belt. So let's make Pluto something else. It was more complicated than that. There were more details to that. But that is the TLDR version of what happened. And in 2006, an entire room full of professional astronomers from around the world raised their colored pieces of paper that designate, yes, I am a member of this organization. And holding those high, they, in a kind of close vote, downvoted Pluto's status, and it was determined we're now going to have dwarf planets, and Pluto would be the lead object in a new group called Plutinos. And I don't think anyone's really used that word since.
No, it's definitely fallen out of favor. Were you there for that vote?
No. Okay. No, I actually, so 2006, I was that August moving from Boston to Edwardsville to start my job as a professor. The very next IAU, I would become a member. But that particular IAU, I was coming up with this show, enjoying just married life and realizing, wow, home ownership is a lot.
right. But normally you do attend the International Astronomical Union meetings, and you've been to others since.
Yes.
Yeah.
And every year the question comes up, is this the year we're going to reopen that can of worms? And every year we're like, nope, this is not.
There is half a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of Task 3 and the whole listening test.